We white Americans need to do a better job of listening when African Americans talk about the seen and unseen barriers you face every day. We need to recognize our privilege and practice humility.
This is the Radio Werewolf News Hour, brought to you by RadioWerewolf.com.
Hopefully they can keep the peace in this process. Hillary Clinton attending a different convention in Ohio this afternoon. She spoke to members of the NAACP in Cincinnati, Ohio. Clinton condemned the attacks against police while also acknowledging nationwide problems with police brutality. She talked about the presumptive Democratic nominee also trying to highlight the differences between her campaign and Donald Trump's. Here's her trying to do that.
My opponent in this race may have a different view, but there's nowhere I'd rather be than right here with all of you. This madness has to stop. Watching the news from Baton Rouge yesterday, my heart broke.
Let's bring in Chris Dyerwald, Fox News digital politics editor and the author of Fox News First. Chris, good to see you. Hillary Clinton speaking in Cincinnati just a little while ago, and clearly she is trying to walk a line here that will maintain her base of support and also help her to sort of bridge the gap between the law and order candidate, right?
Yeah, it's a narrow line she has to walk, because remember, her husband and she was identified with him as a law and order Democrat. As a matter of fact, the laws that are being protested in many cases by the Black Lives Matter movement are the tough on drugs sentencing laws from the Clinton era that were designed to do battle against a crack cocaine epidemic. So she's part of this. The black community in America has been mistrustful of her, especially some of the tactics she used against Barack Obama. Now, polls show them solidly on her side, but it's not something she can take for granted. Meantime, Donald Trump's painting her as against law and order, as against the police, as somebody who doesn't want to protect police officers and is inviting that chaos. So she can't stay there. She can't be stuck in that space, or that's a loser.
Yeah. Yesterday, when the police were shot in Baton Rouge, we noted how long it took for Hillary Clinton to come out with a statement. Yeah. We heard from many politicians, from Donald Trump right away and others, what they thought about Baton Rouge. But it suggests, Chris, that they were thinking long and hard about how they wanted to respond to that, which seems really baffling when you think about it.
If this is the dominant issue of domestic policy for this summer and into the fall, if we continue with this horror, if this continues to happen, this could be a very tough narrative for Hillary Clinton. Now, Donald Trump is not exactly delicate in his messaging on this when he says, I'm the law and order candidate, and it may be a little over the top. And her, out of necessity, she'll have to do two things. One is to say that Trump is insincere and an opportunist and that he doesn't mean it. But number two, and I think you heard that when she called into Bill O'Reilly, I think you heard that in part in her speech today, she's got to remind voters that she is a law and order candidate, that she does have a reputation as being tough and hard, and that may help her shore up some of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. That may be where we see her leaning as she moves forward here. In terms of tonight, Chris, what do you expect? They have to come out of the gate strong here to get people's attention and to have them sit up and say, oh, you know, this might get interesting. Otherwise, they're going to lose them.
Well, there is that. From a television programming point of view, there is that. Tonight, the star attraction would be Donald Trump's wife, who very few Americans know much about. We have not heard a great deal from her. She's done a limited number of interviews. But she's a historical figure. She'd be the first first lady, if he was elected, she'd be the first lady not born in the United States since, I believe, John Quincy Adams' wife. So she's an interesting person. I think people will be tuning in for that. But the overall focus that they're trying to make, what they want to push tonight, is keep America safe is their motto. And they want to say that from a foreign policy point of view and as it relates to law enforcement and police, that Trump and the Republicans stand for order, that Trump and Republicans stand for being tough, being hard. That's the Trump brand, is hard, and America is in need of a little tough love.
Yeah, projecting that strength has been one of the things that has gotten him to this point, and we'll see how he conveys that to the crowd tonight. Chris, thank you so much. Always good to see you. We'll see you in the queue a little bit later tonight. Thanks, buddy.
Donald Trump is set to become the official Republican presidential nominee at the party's national convention soon to start in the city of Cleveland. But during the race for the White House, the billionaire appeared to be waging a war on political correctness. Now appears he may have won. Here's Guyanay Chichikan.
Donald Trump has put forward ideas that no mainstream American politician would dare. In the wake of terror attacks in Europe and in the U.S., he called for a temporary ban on Muslims entering the United States.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
From the very outset of his campaign, Mr. Trump called for a wall along the border with Mexico to stop illegal immigration. Each of these ideas, pundits thought, would bring an end to his presidential bid.
Donald Trump is a bigot and a racist.
Embarrassment to the conservative movement.
Yes! F***ing Trump!
But the pundits soon came to realize that half of America agrees with Donald Trump. A Reuters poll in June showed that 50% of likely voters supported a temporary ban on Muslims entering the U.S.
Some of his comments, which people have suggested, shall we say, outrageous, many people look at those comments and say what he's saying is not only not outrageous, it's actually true. It just happens to be politically incorrect. Many people in this country feel that he is speaking truth to power, truth to the elite. So I think that in many cases, he's right, giving voice to a lot of people who feel that their voice has not been heard for a long time.
As his opponents continued to defend American interventions in wars overseas, Donald Trump blasted them.
Our foreign policy is a complete and total disaster. No vision, no purpose, no direction. No strategy.
Later, even President Obama came to admit a lack of strategy on some of his administration's most critical foreign policy decisions.
Worst mistake.
Failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya.
Donald Trump injected ideas into the national debate that flew in the face of the Washington establishment.
We don't really need NATO in its current form. NATO is obsolete.
I believe we will have a very good relationship with Russia.
I think I'd get along very well with Vladimir Putin.
The more the political establishment and the media criticized Donald Trump, the more headlines he captured.
Many of the people who criticize him are viewed by Mr. Trump's supporters as people who are taking this country in the wrong direction. So they actually see criticism of Donald Trump as a good thing. They see this as a sign that Mr. Trump is actually pricking people in a place where it hurts, and that many of his supporters believe these people need to be pricked and hurt. Many of them see the Trump critics as people who are elite, as people who are out of touch.
Critics have blasted Donald Trump and predicted a quick demise of his political career, only to find out that millions of Americans agree with him. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Shekyan, RT.
Fox News alerts security forces getting their first test as the Republican convention gets underway here in Cleveland. Anti-Trump demonstrators ignoring some of the security rules that were set up by the city, marching toward the convention center. You're getting a look at some of what is going on outside of the queue and outside of the convention center here. Supporters held a rally of their own, with some in the crowd carrying firearms, which is legal in Cleveland, in Ohio, I should say. They have an open carry law that has been the subject of some debate over the past several days here as to whether or not it should be suspended during the convention. Steve Harrigan, live in Cleveland. So, Steve, describe for us what's happening where you are.
Martha, it's really been a delicate balancing act so far. They're about 1 hour into this anti-Trump coalition march. I guess the numbers would be roughly about 1,000 people. And the key test really for security has been, where are they going to be allowed to march? Before this all began, there was a set parade route where all groups were going to have to march. This group has broken those rules, but there has not been any dramatic conflict yet. Instead, the police have been setting up barriers like you're seeing here. They're making a hole for us right now. The police in bicycles instead of patrol cars. The hope is that's going to reduce tension. And they've really been opening up metal gates and blocking the roads with police officers to try and shuttle these protesters away from the convention, but they are not sticking to the parade route so far. No arrests, no violence, about 1,000 strong, some very vocal anti-Trump protesters here, Martha.
All right, Steve, watching the crowd out there as they sort of mill around at this hour, and of course the police here have made it very clear that they want to allow people the opportunity to protest, that that is their right, but that they have to sort of obey, you know, within the parameters of what they want to allow people to carry out there, right, Steve?
We're hearing some... It's a pretty steady chant of these streets are ours, we're going to take over the streets. But when you look at it, the numbers are not overwhelming by any stretch of the imagination, just about 1,000 strong. And the police have been very diplomatic, some of the protesters too diplomatic. We have a lot of people in yellow vests who are trying to work the edges of this crowd and try and prevent any violence from happening. It has not happened yet. They have not gotten close to the convention center, but they have avoided that controlled parade route. This is a loosely organized coalition of all kinds of people who don't like Donald Trump for different reasons. Some have called him a fascist, some have called him anti-immigrant, a coalition of students, union members as well. So many different groups here, but the numbers on this day one of the convention, not large yet, just about under 1,000, I'd say, at this point. Back to you, Martha.
All right, Steve, thank you. Thank you very much for the update out there.
It's amazing what is happening on the racial front. A shamed white woman has now walked into a black Chicago neighborhood on the South Side, emblazoned with the message of white guilt. Unbelievable. Adriana Bigos for CBS News reports that Lorella Willis's methods are turning heads on Chicago's South Side. That's according to CBS 2. They say it's very touching, according to one resident, and they say it here, especially someone who's not colored. They say here that about 20 miles a day, Willis walks with a sign, the one you can see right here. She says she's sorry about everything that's going on in America, the violence, the anger, the racial tension, all of it. She says, I don't want to continue to see black Americans being oppressed and held down and killed like animals. Now, according to WVON radio host Mark Wallace, apparently he spotted Willis walking on 87th Street, and it says here that no one put her up to this. She woke up and decided that white America, there's a problem, and it needs to do something about it. You know, look, I'm not going to disagree with you here that, you know, there is certainly a problem in America, but for a white person to put on a placard and walk through a black neighborhood and apologize, like, what is it going to solve? How are you going to apologize? What are you apologizing for? I mean, I don't feel guilty for being a white male. I don't. And I never will. I've done nothing wrong. Okay? So there's no need for individuals to go ahead and take up the burden of the perceived white shame and make a massive apology to an entire black community. I mean, that's just like disgusting brainwashing that has been driven into this person's mind to make them think that they have to go and apologize for what? You know? I admit that we need to have more unity in this country. We need to be able to work more closer together. I mean, this country is very diverse. There's a lot of different ethnics and ethnicities and people. But that's what makes America great. Let's stop looking at each other by the color of our skin. Let's start looking at each other by, you know, the merits of our work. You know? I don't know. And embrace the cultures. Embrace them. And love them. Don't go and apologize. I mean, white America, what is white America? I mean, there's many different types of white people, you know, from Europe that have many different cultures that they celebrate. So what is white America? How do you even define that? It's just, I don't know. Black America, I'm sorry, come on. What are your thoughts about this woman trying to take up the burden of white America and apologize for the sins of the white man in today's day and age? For the Next News Network, I'm Gary Franchi.
News: three police officers have been confirmed dead after a shooting in the U.S. city of Baton Rouge, that's in Louisiana. The incident happened early on Sunday, not far from a local police headquarters. It was when a group of gunmen opened fire on officers. The number of those injured is still unclear, with reports suggesting a total of seven officers were hit. One of the shooters has been killed, and two others are believed to be at large, according to the city's sheriff's office. Baton Rouge is the city where less than 2 weeks ago a policeman shot 37-year-old Alton Sterling dead in an incident that prompted mass protests. In the past few weeks, there have been a spate of attacks on the police across the United States. The biggest occurred in Dallas on July 7th. That was when a lone sniper killed five officers during an anti-police brutality rally. The Dallas shooter was killed following a standoff with police. He was later identified as a 25-year-old Army reservist who'd been deployed to Afghanistan for several months. The shooter acted alone, but said that he was upset about the killing of African Americans by police and was aiming to take down white officers. It's live to our US correspondent, Gane Chichikan now. Gane, what can you tell us about this latest incident?
We know that one attacker in Baton Rouge is dead. Police are looking for other possible shooters. The mayor of Baton Rouge said that the officers who were killed were responding to a call of shots fired when they were ambushed by at least one gunman. Three officers were killed, three are in critical condition. The police said that the public should be on the lookout for people dressed in black and carrying long guns. Again, they are looking for other possible shooters, but it has not been confirmed that there were any. We do not know the identity of the attacker who was gunned down, and we do not know whether any of the killed officers was involved in the death of Alton Sterling. Baton Rouge has been ground zero for protests against police brutality after Alton Sterling was killed on July 6. The FBI issued a warning that a police purge was being planned in Baton Rouge, and the killing of these three Baton Rouge police officers is happening just a week after five police officers were killed by a shooter in Dallas, who said it was in response to the killing of black men by law enforcement in other parts of the country.
Okay, thanks to Gane Chichikan with the latest there from Washington, D.C. Now, let's get more on this story. We can speak to human rights activist Clark Stockley, joins us on the line.
Thank you.
Clark, welcome. It's not clear at the moment exactly the details of the shooter or shooters, but it's obvious there's going to be links made by the public to racial motivation, if not for any other reason than the fact that a black man was killed in that city in Baton Rouge just under 2 weeks ago. Do you think that's fair for people to make that connection?
I think it's way too early to make that connection until we have any evidence of a motive. It could have merely been a robbery going on, or we don't know. So it's too early to make that connection. Obviously, people will because of the short time it's been since Alton Sterling's murder.
The issue of police brutality is a very sensitive one at the moment, when officers are often accused of using excessive force. It's a difficult situation for the police now, though, because they're the ones who are coming under attack. How do they deal with any hostility that they encounter on the streets? They're worried to use any kind of force, but they also must fear for their own lives.
Sure. So they need to be better trained in de-escalation tactics. And the fact of the matter is attacks are happening all over the world. every day. And that is essentially what a police officer is signing up for, is to defend the population and to put their lives in danger. And so while that's going on, we as activists and citizens need to both stand up for our rights, stand up for protesting, but meanwhile we need to be doing it in a peaceful way, and also, you know, realize that every action has a reaction. So nothing is no violence is going to beget peace, and that needs to be a message that is widely understood on both the activists as well as the police.
Are the police doing enough to get themselves in a situation where they're not going to be accused of using excessive force? Because we seem to have more shootings year on year now. The Black Lives Matter movement is definitely growing. Have the police done anything to kind of improve the situation?
Well, for the most part, Black Lives Matter protests have been extremely peaceful. We've had, maybe some lone wolves who had their own agenda. But the fact of the matter is protests have always been peaceful. And for the most part, 99.9% of everyone that feels anger towards the police has done so in a very civilized manner. What really needs to happen is police training needs to focus on de-escalation. They also need to learn how to work in the communities better and make themselves more relatable to their populations. And then, we continue to need more police video cams, body cams, because obviously all of the videos that we've been seeing have been shot by passersby. And so we need to go through a lot of changes, systematic changes. We need to work on having police forces that more represent the population that they serve. And the list goes on and on, but there's going to need to be major changes across the board, across the country, in how our police forces deal with violence and so forth. So it's not going to be something that happens over a few days or in one department. It's going to have to be a major systematic change all across this country.
We had the shootings, several policemen killed in Dallas. The FBI issued a warning that they feared there was going to be a purge against police in Baton Rouge. Now we see these shootings. Are you concerned this could be the start of something that will snowball, with people sort of dishing out their own justice on the streets?
Well, I think the United States has a long history of gun violence, both by angry citizens and, as well as the police. So this being an election year where the rhetoric has gotten very racist and people have probably been more divided in this country than any other time since the Civil War, I expect there to be violence of all kinds, of random shooters, and it's not going to be something that we can easily fix with the law. So it's going to need to be a cultural paradigm shift of working towards peace, and that's going to have to come from both sides, because as I said, every action has a reaction.
Okay, our guest this hour is human rights activist Clark Stockley. Many thanks, Clark.
Thank you.
Three police officers are confirmed dead in the U.S. city of Baton Rouge. The gunman has been identified as a former Marine. State authorities say he ambushed officers and specifically sought out police. The alleged gunman posted this clip online ahead of the killings.
So I know they would try to arrest me, and I know I would die right there, because you're not going to kidnap me.
Well, the shooting occurred on Sunday morning after police responded to reports of a suspicious person with a rifle. An exchange of gunfire followed between police and the suspect. Six officers were shot in total, with three killed and three more injured. Reports suggest two suspects might still be on the loose, while the shooter himself was killed. Alexei Roshevsky has the details.
The shooter, the assailant, has been identified as a 29-year-old former Marine, African-American, Gavin Long, who served in Iraq from 2005-2010. He was honorably discharged in 2010 and even got a medal for his service. One thing which is completely unavoidable here, but nobody really talks about at this moment, the striking resemblance between him, between Gavin Long, the Baton Rouge shooter, and Micah Johnson, the shooter in Dallas. Both served in the Army. One was a former Marine. The other one was just military. Both had foreign tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, respectively. Both were active on social media and sending very strong messages about, you know, racial profiling, policing in the country. This is basically suggesting that those are not your ordinary Joes. Those are people with training experience, with military experience, and they carried serious weapons, AR-15 rifle in the case of Gavin Long and a sniper rifle in the case of the Dallas shooter, Micah Johnson. So the police right now all across America is on high alert because they're even talking of something of a purge against the police with such shooters on the loose. And now we have 8 policemen dead in the space of last 10 days. So this problem has been very real after Dallas shooting of proper street warfare. It forced the president of the United States to come out several times over the past several weeks and say basically the same things about the division, which is growing very strong in the country.
I believe that I speak for every single American when I say that we are horrified over these events and that we stand united with the people and the police department in Dallas. Regardless of race or political party or profession, focus on words and actions that can unite this country rather than divide it further.
Very similar statements indeed, and it shows that the problem is real. It's in your face. We've seen it before after the Ferguson uprising. We've seen it after the Eric Garner protests in New York with hundreds of thousands of people, but this time it's getting more and more serious, and the president says this all the time right now.
Well, before being elected president, Barack Obama pledged to curb racial tensions in the United States, but years on, the issue is still far from being resolved.
According to a statement from Daytona Beach Police, dispatch received a call of a vehicle fire at 2:30 a.m. Sunday. Responding officers found a marked Daytona Beach police car fully engulfed in flames in front of the Islamic Center of Daytona Beach. The car was being used as a ghost car to deter crime in the area. Fire crews responded and put the fire out. No one was injured. Police said this note was found near the scene of the fire. Investigators found a note that said, "Black Lives Matter. A. Sterling P. Castile," and referred to police using an expletive. It's unclear exactly where the note was found. The burning comes amid rising tension nationwide following the fatal police shootings of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Philando Castile in suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. Also Sunday, a gunman shot and killed 3 law enforcement officers in Baton Rouge.
In response to the recent string of high-profile murders committed in the name of the Black Lives Matter movement, heads of the American Psychiatry Organization, APO, released a statement confirming the existence of a new pernicious mental disorder plaguing the minds of people across the nation. Quote, "Given the recent Dallas shooting that left 5 officers dead, as well as the WDBJ murders committed last year, we have concluded that the shooters in each case likely suffered from Black Lives Matter disorder, a variant of paranoid schizophrenia marked by an obsessive-compulsive belief in an obscure force that patients refer to as white supremacy or, alternatively, white privilege. According to the statement, symptoms of Black Lives Matter disorder include believing that facts are inherently racist, a peculiar aversion to statistics and logic, an irrational belief in a non-existent force called white supremacy, seeing racism where absolutely none exists, and in extreme cases, going on brutal, murderous rampages on live TV. In regards to the WDBJ shooting from 2015, the APL statement elaborated, quote, "New evidence based on accounts from multiple workers at WDBJ suggests that the shooter was irrationally convinced that racism lurked around every corner, even accusing co-workers of racial discrimination with absolutely no evidence. According to Trevor Fair, a cameraman at WDBJ for 6 years, Bryce would accuse the staff of racism for the most irrelevant things. Quote, "We would say stuff like, the reporter's out in the field. And he would look at us and say, what are you saying, cotton fields? That's racist." On a separate occasion, a manager brought watermelon for all the employees. And according to Trevor, Bryce Williams said, "You're doing that because of me. You guys are calling me out because I'm black." This kind of delusional belief that racism exists around every corner is the essence of the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been instrumental in perpetuating myths about an obscure force they call white supremacy, which they claim is responsible for the deaths of numerous innocent blacks in recent high-profile cases involving Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, and Alton Sterling, among others. The more extreme cases of Black Lives Matter disorder include a paranoid schizophrenic belief in something called white privilege. Patients often cite the most obscure, dubious clues as evidence of their theory, suspending logic and critical thinking to push the narrative that an elite group of white people are plotting to destroy blacks. This delusional paranoia was no better exemplified than in the aftermath of the tragic Dylann Roof shooting, where patients of BLM disorder shared memes on social media which they claim proved the existence of white privilege. The following is a tweet posted by one Black Lives Matter sympathizer showing the arrest of Dylann Roof, with the caption, "White privilege is murdering 9 people and then having the police give you a bulletproof vest but not handcuffs." Of course, it was later revealed that the above image was an optical illusion, and the supposed free, uncuffed hand of Dylann Roof was just the arm of the officer standing right behind him. Here is another popular meme shared by patients as proof of white privilege, by one leader of the Black Lives Matter movement, D-Ray McKesson, who tweeted, quote, "They put Dylann in a bulletproof vest as he walked to the police car. Watch whiteness work." Sadly, the severity of Black Lives Matter disorder prevented patients from using simple logic or research to find countless other examples throughout history of black suspected murderers being escorted in bulletproof vests. Like Lee Boyd Malvo, a black man involved in the DC sniper shootings, killed 16 people, was racially motivated, was apprehended without incident, and yes, given a bulletproof vest. And this is only scratching the surface of real-world examples of Black Lives Matter disorder. In September 2015, patients with BLM disorder at the University of Delaware thought they'd witnessed a hate crime after finding ropes dangling from a tree like nooses. However, it was later revealed that the nooses were just strings used for tree lanterns at a recent college party. In April of 2016, at Indiana Bloomington University, a priest in a robe was mistaken for a KKK member, whipping the entire campus up into a collective episode of BLM disorder. One patient with Black Lives Matter disorder posted this urgent tweet, "IU students, be careful. There's someone walking around in KKK gear with a whip." The American Psychiatry Organization's press release specifically stressed the unsettling organizational capacities of patients, who for years now have gathered under the Black Lives Matter movement. But the APO warns, quote, "Do not be fooled by the apparent organizational powers of patients with BLM disorder. Although they masquerade as a political and social justice movement, they are essentially nothing more than a congregation of mentally ill people feeding into each other's paranoid schizophrenic delusions. The remaining staff at WDBJ are completely baffled by the shooter's accusations of workplace racism." WDBJ General Manager Jeff Marks said, quote, "Bryce quickly gathered a reputation as someone who was difficult to work with. He was sort of looking out for people to say things he could take offense to." Marks went on to say that he believes the claims of racial discrimination were fabricated. In other words, the shooter was imagining racism where none existed.
I'm James Vallis. A man has been shot by police after attacking tens of people inside a passenger train near the city of Würzburg in the German state of Bavaria, that according to local media. As many as 21 people have been injured. The incident happened late on Monday evening when the man, who was not immediately identified, began attacking people with an axe on a passenger train. Local radio reporting that at least 21 people were injured in the attack before the suspect was shot by police. Some of those injured were said to have been seriously injured, but specific details were not immediately known. There was also no word on the condition of the suspect. There was also no immediate word on the possible motive for the axe attack.
Frustration is growing among the French after a third terror attack in their country in less than 2 years. The French Prime Minister Manuel Valls has been booed and jeered in Nice as he attended a memorial service for the victims of last week's deadly terror attack in the city. The crowd also called for the government's resignation as Valls and other local politicians left the scene of Bastille Day carnage. The administration of French President François Hollande has been under mounting criticism for its inability to prevent three major terrorist attacks in the past 18 months. The latest incident saw a man plowing through a crowd with a truck, killing 84 people. A recent poll shows that the public has lost its confidence in the government's capacity to handle security. Survey's findings, published in the French paper Le Figaro, show that only a third of respondents had faith in the current leadership's ability to combat terrorism. Gérard Coleman is a political analyst who joins us from Paris. Gérard Coleman, do you think the French have a right to lose faith in their politicians and the security apparatus that is supposed to safeguard their country against them?
Absolutely. There have been major police measures since the previous attacks in November of 2015, and yet we see this major atrocity occurring on a national holiday day where you should have top security. It should have been impossible for an attack of this scale to occur, and yet it did. So the most people should pose questions about the effectiveness of the French security system. People should also pose questions about what actually happened. Being told 84 people were slaughtered by that truck, yet the truck itself doesn't have any blood on it. And the pictures I've seen, there are lots of questions to do with what actually happened to the driver. He seems to have been riddled with bullets at the very front of the truck, at the windscreen, and then he seems to have come out. So maybe he was wearing a security vest or bulletproof vest. But there was another chap who was arrested at the scene as well, and he remains unidentified. We don't know whether he was involved or not. So people should not only be questioning the effectiveness of the security apparatus in France, but also what exactly happened in this particular attack in Nice. So there's a lot of questions to be posed about how effective police measures are and what exactly happened during the attacks.
If you were taking a look at the road that France has ahead of itself, we know that they are still partaking in the wars that are occurring, in particular the war on Syria. Do you think they are doing enough in order to eradicate terrorists, purging them from the country? And or is this the result of their foreign policy adventures, such as the one in Syria?
Well, there are two possible ways to look at the Islamic State in terms of their attacks in Europe. Either it's blowback from the fact that they're supporting these people in Syria. Let's be clear, Bashar al-Assad, the Iranians, the Russians are fighting ISIS. The West is supporting them, either directly or indirectly. So it's a myth to say that they're fighting against ISIS in Syria. Now, either this is blowback, in other words, they're supporting them in Syria because they want to destroy the Syrian state and take over the Middle East. And this is a blowback, this is a consequence that they've been unable to prevent. Or this is also to their advantage. In other words, that these attacks are essentially false flag attacks, or psychological operations designed to drive on the war on terrorism and create further justification for an escalation of military intervention in Syria. So they're the only two possibilities. The notion that they're actually fighting ISIS doesn't make any sense. If they were fighting ISIS, they would be supplying Bashar al-Assad with arms. They would be supplying him with weapons and airplanes and so on, and fighter jets and so on. They are not supporting Assad. Everybody knows that the opposition, so-called moderate rebels in Syria, are terrorists. They're ISIS, they're al-Nusra, they're al-Qaeda, and they're getting arms from the West and its closest allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. So to say that they're fighting ISIS is a myth. So the French people need to wake up. If they want the terror to stop, if they want the police state measures to be rolled back, then they need to understand what the war on terrorism is. And in order to do that, they'll have to look at other media sources, other sources of information. They won't get that from their own corporate government-controlled media, which is part of the problem and not the solution. So again, we need to be clear. The only two possibilities with respect to ISIS is either a blowback, that this is a consequence of their foreign policy that they've been unable to prevent, or that it's a false flag psychological operation scenario, where, again, the more terrorist attacks you have, more civil liberties are cracked down upon, and the more justification you create for foreign military interventions. I would say that the latter is more plausible, because they're not that stupid. They're not going to continue supplying terrorists in Syria, realizing that these people are going to strike them at home if they don't want them to strike at home. It seems to me that they do want these terrorist attacks to occur. And we also need to pose questions about what these terrorist attacks actually are. We're not quite sure. We're being told lots of things about this attack, but to me, a lot of questions that need to be asked, and nobody in the media is doing that.
Thank you for that. Gérard Colmar, political analyst there from Paris.
Dear President Obama, I told you this before. Either arrest Fethullah Gulen or return him to Turkey. You didn't listen. I call on you again. After there was a coup attempt, extradite this man in Pennsylvania to Turkey. If we're strategic partners or model partners, do what is necessary.
As we've just heard, President Erdogan accused the Islamic cleric Mohammed Fethullah Gulen of being behind the coup attempt. Gulen denies any part in it. Gulen's currently living in self-imposed exile in the US. He's the leader of the Hizmet movement, uniting Turks who support Gulen's ideas on Islam and democracy. Turkey has in the past demanded his extradition from the United States and branded his group a terrorist organization. The Turkish Prime Minister said that a nation supporting Gulen can't be Turkey's ally.
We all know that Fethullah Gulen is the leader of a terrorist organization. In light of what happened that night, I cannot imagine a country that could support that person. The nation supporting this person is not a friend of Turkey. It is an open enemy of Turkey.
The US Secretary of State has asked Turkey to provide, quote, any legitimate evidence of Gulen's involvement in the military uprising. And to discuss this in more detail, let's cross live to political analyst Daniel Patrick Welchsteiner is on the line. Daniel, Gulen has been living in the US, specifically in Pennsylvania, for many years now. Do you think that the US intelligence services would have been keeping a close eye on him?
Well, they could have been, but he can also be a patsy for US intelligence services or working with them. You know, there are other sources from within Turkey, reports from anti-Erdogan groups that despite the paranoid sound of his accusations, have backed his version of this, that this is a Saudi and Gulen-backed attempt to push back against Erdogan for his recent rapprochement with Russia and proposals to normalize relations with Turkey, Syria, sorry.
Now, earlier, the Turkish Prime Minister called Gulen a terrorist. He said the country housing him is no friend of Turkey. It's pretty strong rhetoric. Do you think there's a danger of a major diplomatic rift with Washington over this?
Well, that would be closing the barn door after the horse has left if the U.S. gave the green light or the U.S. is found to have been behind it. You know, they're the ones who made the major diplomatic rift. But I was quite stunned by the harshness of those words to say that they're no friend of the U.S. because the U.S. desperately wants and needs a belligerent, Russophobic Turkey on Syria's borders and on the Bosphorus. They want to keep the pressure on Russia, and so they need Erdogan as an ally. This could have been some sort of a not a feeble attempt at a coup, just to show Erdogan that he's not safe in his position if he continues this line. He's always promoted ISIS. He's responsible for countless deaths in Syria because of his support of the Death Squad project. But now he's realizing that it's failed, and maybe he's taking another tack, and there are some elements that don't like it. That's perfectly possible.
Of course, the U.S. could just hand Gulen over to Turkey. That'd smooth things over very, very quickly. Do you think that's likely? They'll extradite him?
That's absolutely. I would bet my life that they would not do that, because that's an admission of diplomatic. They're not hiding him. They're not sequestered. They can never say, admit to that. And so, therefore, they couldn't give him over, because that would be admitting that there was something to extradite. What we'll do is just pretend that they have nothing to do with it. There are rumors of ties between Gulen and the Clinton Foundation, and Clinton herself has promised a more muscular foreign policy. This could be a shades of a Clinton presidency to come, God forbid.
We talked about U.S.-Turkey relations. They soured over Turkey's crackdown on the Kurds, U.S. supporting the Kurds at times in Syria. Ankara's been trying to mend its relations, it seemed, bit of a U-turn in relations with Russia and Israel. Are we seeing a major shift in alliances here, do you think?
That remains to be seen. That's why I was, my ears perked up when I heard the harshness of those words. The rhetoric, it seems to be mirroring that kind of a shift. There was the apology over the shootdown of the Russian plane was downplayed. And also there's rapprochement with Israel at the same time. So there's not really, in a deep sense, there's not a huge evidence of a change. But given the fact that the U.S. so desperately needs such an attack dog as an ally, any kind of minor shift in the direction back toward Russia and toward normalization of relationships with a sovereign Syrian state is very bad news for the U.S. indeed.
I'm speaking to writer and political analyst Daniel Patrick Welch. Many thanks.
But the Islamic cleric is now not only the only divisive issue for the NATO allies. America currently finds itself sealed off from its nuclear warheads located right now at Turkey's Incirlik Air Base. That's after Ankara blocked all movement in and out of the facility, halting U.S.-led airstrikes on Syria from this strategic base. Power to the base has also been cut. It's now understood that access has been restored. However, the incident has sparked deep concerns in Washington. Let's cross live now to Savim Dardalin, joining us here on RT International, a German MP from the Left Party. Savim, very nice to see you. Thanks for coming on the program. To what extent do you think could the instability in Turkey actually compromise its role in NATO and, I suppose, its image as a reliable partner?
Well, I'm afraid that there will be no major changes between the NATO and Turkey, because the NATO geopolitical interests are once more heavy than any human rights issue or instability in Turkey. The NATO and especially the USA need Turkey for its role for the regime change policies in the Middle East. And therefore, I think there will be no major changes between the relationships between Turkey and the NATO.
All right, so the relationship between Ankara and NATO will more or less stay the same as you say. But what about the relationship between the EU and Turkey, the ongoing refugee or migrant crisis, the billions of euros from Brussels to Ankara, this whole Turkey-EU relationship, any effect, do you think, in the wake of this attempted military coup?
Well, it's going to be a little bit more difficult for both sides to publicly have a strong cooperation because of the accession process of Turkey into the European Union membership. But as you said, it's a very important partner for the European Union, especially for Germany, regarding the refugee issue and to stop the refugee crisis. So they have a convention and a treaty, and European Union is very interested that Turkey will still hold the refugees. And another point is that the visa liberalization issue is going on. despite the fact that, I mean, as your reporter said, there are almost 3,000 judges fired by Erdogan at the moment. He's crushing the opposition. Erdogan and Islamist fans of him, they are attacked the pro-Kurdish party, HDP, last night in several cities in Turkey. So despite all these facts, and despite the fact that the European Union knows that Turkey plays a really bad role in the Syrian civil war, like supporting terrorist groups like the Islamic State or Ahrar al-Sham with arms, they don't stop even the arms exports to Turkey. So I cannot see that there will be a major change in the European Union relationship to Turkey as well as the NATO. It's both the same. They need Turkey for the their regime change policies in the Middle East. They need them to handle the refugee crisis issue. Therefore, there will be no changes.
It's interesting, as you say, there'll be no changes in the NATO relationship, but also interesting that you say that Turkey and its porous border has in effect been allowing ISIS to thrive, militants going over the border into Syria, weapons flowing into the border, over the border into Syria with the help of Turkey, although Turkey denies it. Do you think America is aware of Turkey's alleged role with the terrorists in Syria?
I bet they are. I mean, we know from the German security services that they are all from other countries like the US, the Great Britain, even the Germans. They do have spies everywhere there in the region. I mean, Syria and the borders around Syria is the most most observed area at the moment in the world, and they are all about security services, all about Syria and the borders. And they know, and at least they know it from last year, federal German investigation program on TV published the information given by the BND, the German security service, that Turkey is supporting Islamic groups, fighters like Ahrar al-Sham or the Islamic Front in Syria in this civil war with arms. And despite this fact, whether the US nor Germany is stopping the arms exports to Turkey, I think it's a bit of the part of the dirty game played by the US and the NATO in Syria. They are supporting Turkey, which is supporting Islamic groups like the Islamic State or Ahrar al-Sham in Syria. And in the, on the other side, they are supporting, for example, the Kurdish people in Syria. It's all of contradictions, but this is the game of imperialist politics played by the U.S.
I'm sorry to jump in, but I'm listening to everything you've said here, and most of the information you've said is out in the public domain. But Turkey does insist that it's a victim of terrorism and that it's fighting terrorism.
Well, we don't know. Who is responsible for the attack in Suruç last year? That was the first big terrorist attack made by groups against socialist young people, freedom and peace-loving people who were supporting Kobane and the Kurdish Rojava region in north of Syria. And we don't know till now who is responsible for this big terrorist attack in Ankara, for the big terrorist attack in Istanbul. The Islamic State didn't say that they have been doing it. And so that's why I don't know if there is any other group leaded by Erdogan and his friends. For example, the coup attempt in Turkey now. We are not clear if there were really strong elements, not strong elements of a false flag operation now, because at the moment, who benefits the most from this coup attempt is Erdogan. And it's remarkable that Erdogan had very detailed information about the coup at a very early stage, for example, and that he decided to fly to Istanbul, in spite he knew there were Air Force units involved. So that makes me really, well, I'm asking myself who was ordering this coup attempt, because at the moment, as we can see, we have to speak about Erdogan's coup in Turkey. He's crushing the opposition, he is firing judges, he is firing the militaries, and so that we really have to talk about Erdogan's coup in Turkey at the moment.
All right, Sevim Dardalin, German MP from the Left Party, joining us live here on RT International. Many thanks for your insight today.
They finally released the 28 pages, well, most of it, about 90% of it. Some of it's still redacted. I'm not surprised at all that they're avoiding Israel. However, they really shot themselves in the foot, because the entire thing is based on FBI field office reports, which is perfect, because all I did to uncover the Israeli role was quote and cite the same field office reports, the same as the Senate is doing. They redacted the Saudi role, they didn't even write about the Israeli role, but it's there in the exact same primary sources that they use themselves. So now they have no way out of this. And I went over many times, you can look back as recently as last April, I was talking about Omar Bayoumi and Osama Basnan and how they had gotten money from Bandar Bush, you know, through their wives, and gave it to Al-Mihdhar and Al-Hazmi. I've said that story in like 20 different radio shows many, many times. Everything in the 28 pages I had already said on YouTube, and all of it was spelled out in The Empire Unmasked. I'm going to have a video out tomorrow, chalkboard video style. Yes, it's coming back, explaining how the money was transferred around and who was involved. And what we're also going to do is look at the Israeli role, because the same field office reports that nailed the Saudis to the wall that are used in the GIS report cover the Israeli role, and it's far larger. It's 1,800 pages worth of material on Israel's role in 9/11. So now we got them. I'm excited about this. This is awesome. Called it, everything thing in it, everything they said about the money and the Saudi role, I had already uncovered. I'm very happy about that. There was nothing surprising. The only name they mentioned was the naval officer, which the only reason I hadn't mentioned that is because I couldn't pronounce it. I had just written it down. But everything is in the Empire Unmasked, the Saudi role, the Israeli role, as well as a lot about ISIS and narco trafficking, the Contra Affair, a broad history. It's a 5-hour film. It's on ANC Report. You can buy it. It helps finance trips and things. I'm going to get the pictures of the dancing Israelis flicking lighters and stuff. That is one of the other reasons I need to get to the U.S., to go to L.A. We're also screening the film for Occupation of the American Mind with Sat Jolly, who's coming over. TUT is coming from Australia. This event is getting bigger and bigger. We got about half of it financed so far. So please go to ancreport.com. Consider donating. Consider getting The Empire Unmasked if you haven't seen it yet. And I will be breaking down 28 pages tomorrow. I haven't had time tonight. I got the blue screen of death from Windows. What perfect timing. Turkish coup attempt, and the 28 pages are released, and my computer's down. But anyway, I feel completely vindicated, because everything I said was going to be in there was in there, and at the same time, they just condemned themselves on Israel. This is perfect.
Bandar Bush hires Omar Bayoumi and Osama Basnan, and both of them and their wives help facilitate money through Riggs Bank to 9/11 hijackers living in California. Not a damn secret. Hires Omar Bayoumi and Osama Basnan, and both of them and their wives help facilitate money through Riggs Bank to 9/11 hijackers living in California. Not a damn secret.
Lastly, if you got an email from Gopher Central, from Gopher anything about ANC Report and a newsletter, yes, that is real. That is not spam. Please go there and sign up to that. We are going to have a weekly newsletter, and my report on the 28 pages will be in there, as well as my thoughts on the recent coup attempt, etc. I have a lot to say about these 28 pages. It is a much bigger deal than people realize. They're just going over stuff that, if you've been watching me, we've all known for years. They're just now saying, wow, look at this direct connection to Bandar Bush, blah, blah, blah. That is not the half of it. They're missing the boat on the Safari Club and the Israeli connections. It's just so much bigger, and they've really screwed themselves